The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. He hath said it. He might not have been a fool when he first said it, but he became a fool. Maybe saying there was no God was a starting point. But that declaration that there is no God leads to all sorts of perverse ramifications. If you go to a jewelry store to purchase a select jewel, and that salesman knows what he's doing, he may get you under a very bright white light over that glass counter and lay out some black velvet in order to display his jewels. Because against that black backdrop, you can see the cut. You can see the hue, the clarity, the beauty. And in the same way, I do not believe that we can appreciate the luster, the beauty, the brilliance of the gospel, its hope, its grace, its glory, if we've never seen the backdrop of sin as it really is. It's a depressing sight, but it's the truth. In the first chapter of the Roman letter, the Apostle Paul is like a prosecuting attorney with a portfolio full of evidence relating to the condition of man. He's so effusive about this that it takes him through chapter 1 and chapter 2 and then on through chapter 3. The condition of man is hopeless. And this must be acknowledged because the gospel cannot deliver anyone who will not admit that he is a sinner. In verse 18 of chapter 1 in the Roman letter, Paul says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven." This is the wrath of God in contrast to verse 17, where he's already spoken of the righteousness of God. I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it's the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes it, whether he's Jewish or Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith. This is contrasted with the wrath of God in the next verse. Man is unrighteous. Man needs righteousness. But man has no hope of any righteousness from within himself. As he'll conclude in chapter 3, there is none righteous. No, not one. Now we're living in a world, as you've already heard this morning, to where the pendulum has swung to talking about the sweet love of God, which indeed it is. But Paul here is talking about the wrath of God because the holy, righteous God of heaven is a God also of terrible, terrible wrath. This is not the term thumos in the Greek, which might mean a quick wind of wrath, a sudden losing of temper before recomposure. But the word here is orge. It has to do with God's holy aversion of all that is evil. And it is a settled, abiding condition that is constant. Not a sudden burst of anger. That's not this wrath of God. But a sustained, settled condition dating all the way back to the garden. We've been under the wrath of God since that time. And the wrath of God is revealed. It is revealed. That's present tense. A story was told to me over in Illinois one time about a cynical farmer whose field surrounded three sides of a little meeting house which sat on the road in a rural area. And this farmer would farm 7 days a week, taking special delight on the Lord's Day in the morning of plowing or driving his tractor right by the windows of that meeting house and waving to the people who were on the inside. He took a special cynical delight in this. And when one October he harvested a bumper crop of corn off that field, he wrote a letter to the paper that said, "There is no God. I've harvested corn right in the shadow of the meeting house. And there's no God. I farmed it 7 days a week, Sunday and all." One perceptive Christian wrote to the paper too and stated the truth that God does not settle all his accounts in October. Perfectly true. The wrath of God is revealed, but it is a settled, abiding condition. It's not a sudden burst of anger at the moment you do something wrong or at the moment that I stray from the path. It is the abiding condition upon all mankind. The wrath of God is revealed in the present tense. It's continually being revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. The wrath of God is revealed against ungodliness. This is man's rejection of the person of God. He is ungodly. He's rejecting God. What makes man ungodly? Man becomes ungodly when he suppresses the truth about God. That's what the word hold here means. They hold back the truth. They restrain it. They suppress it. Man sees the evidence and he purposefully turns his back against it. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. For God hath showed it unto them. Verse 19. This is the reason that man is under the wrath of God. Because there is evidence right within them, within the inner conscience of man. He talks more about the law of conscience in chapter 2. And there is evidence exterior to man as well. Man stumbles over the evidence everywhere he looks, within or without, but yet he suppresses that truth. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and godhood, so that they are without excuse. It's all around man. God has left very large footprints throughout his creation. The sea, the mountains, the design that we see everywhere through microscopes, through telescopes, shows us that there is design and therefore there must have been a designer. The story is told that Napoleon, just shortly after the French Revolution, was walking on the deck of one of his ships when he heard some of his generals laughing and scoffing about the existence of God, because that was the popular notion at that time. There was an affirmation of atheism upon which the French state was founded. Napoleon, having heard what they were talking about on that clear night under the panoply of stars, turned around and walked back to these generals and said, "But gentlemen, first you must get rid of these." How true that is. Heinrich von Luhn, who was a journalist and writer some time ago, went to Arizona and visited the Grand Canyon and walked away shaking his head, saying, "I came an atheist, but I leave a believer." But when you see the handiwork of God, when you see all these evidences of design, which are just as apparent to the pygmy in the bush as they are to the businessman in the concrete jungle, when you see these evidences, you can turn them off. And man has. How is it that God can hold man responsible because he has given them evidence? Clear, unmistakable, incontestable evidence that God created. So that God has every reason to say that man is without excuse, he's totally without a defense. The heavens are telling of the glory of God. And the firmament, the expanse, is declaring the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech. Night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. It's as silent as light, and yet just as clear. Indeed, their line has gone out into the whole earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. The unmistakable evidence of the footprints of God. Einstein said, "As we make these discoveries, we are only, in a small measure, thinking God's thoughts after him." The first chapter of Genesis does not set out to prove anything. It simply declares, "In the beginning, God created." Simply sets forth that fact. This is a fact that is evident all around us. The fact that we have life and consciousness declares it. The temperature of the sun in this solar system is 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit. All the heat, indeed all the energy we have on this planet, comes directly or indirectly from the sun. Our Earth is approximately 93 million miles from the sun, so that the sun would be neither too hot nor too cold for us. If the average temperature of the earth were either 50 degrees hotter or 50 degrees colder than it is, life on this planet would cease to exist. We complained this summer when it was hotter and drier than usual. But if it were a mere 50 degrees hotter or colder on the average than it is, we couldn't even survive. Why is the sun 12,000 degrees? Why not 24,000? Why not 2,000? And why is the earth just the distance it is from the sun? Why not twice as far or half as far? The earth rotates 365 times a year as it passes around the sun. Suppose it rotated only 36 times a year. This would make, of course, our days and our nights 10 times as long as they are. We'd be extremely hot on one side of the planet and unbearably cold on the other side, and life again would be impossible. Is this by chance? The earth rotates on an axis of 23 degrees. This gives us our seasons of the year. Why not an axis of 45 degrees? Why not straight up and down? If it were straight up and down, it would be so terrifically hot at the equator, it would be unbearable to live there, and ice would form at the poles, building up until the earth itself would actually split apart at the middle. The air we breathe is 21% oxygen. All of the oxygen on our planet could have been taken up on the surface of the planet as it was in most of the other planets that we know about. As a matter of fact, if that had occurred, the crust of the earth would only be 10 feet thicker than it is now, if all the oxygen were in the crust rather than in the atmosphere. Why was 21% oxygen left in the atmosphere? Why not 10%? Why not 50% so that the first time there was a fire, there'd be a mass conflagration? Do you believe this is all by chance? There are thousands of such examples as these. It is utterly impossible scientifically, it's scientifically and mathematically both impossible, that the conditions on this earth, which has been made so receptive to life, came about by accident. And that's what Paul is saying. That's all Paul has said. That God has made it evident within them, and God has made it evident to them, and the more we learn, the more evidence there is. But man has suppressed it. It's not so much that I just can't believe there's a designer, it's that I won't believe there's a designer. I have reasons for not wanting to believe that. And yet the incongruity of believing there is a design without a designer is beyond reason. A plan without a planner? No wonder man is without excuse. What does man do when he does not want to be accountable? Well, Paul details that for us as he lists the steps down to degradation that men make. Verse 21 in Romans 1. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful. Now here's the first step. They knew God originally. Originally, of course, Adam and Eve knew God. And their offspring and their offspring knew God. And so we don't start from a position where man comes out of a slimy ooze and eventually invents gods for himself. Biblically, we have the opposite condition where man knows God, but he doesn't like it. And so he refuses to retain God in his knowledge. Man willfully ignores God. Neither is thankful. He doesn't have to express his thanks before he eats a meal. Because these foods were provided by a natural evolutionary process, not by a personal creative God. He doesn't have to be thankful for them. So they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful. What does he do next? They became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. They weren't fools when they started this process, but they became fools. Man first willfully ignores God, and then, perhaps to salve his conscience, he cleverly reasons against God. The mind of man is created in the image of God, whether man believes in God or not. And he's very clever and subtle in what he can come up with as speculation to take the place of God. Futile speculations from brilliant men who are actually attempting to imitate God and take over the place of God themselves. We have a better plan. Here's how it really happened. This is what really occurred. The tricky thing about futile speculation is that it doesn't come across as futile speculation at the time that it's in fashion. Let a theory become fashionable. Let it become axiomatic among people. Let it become widely accepted. And see how many more people will accept it who hear it for the first time and become inured to the particular trends in that culture than would accept it if it was out of fashion. Look at some theories that a few years ago were the fashionable, the trendy. And now maybe they've fallen out of fashion and they seem ridiculous, but back at the time, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, this was the current thought. Go back and read the intellectual literature of this country in the 1930s and see how enamored they were of communism as the coming panacea to solve the political problems of the earth and economic problems. Now, many of these intellectuals in our country later on veered sharply to the right when it became apparent that communism was not the utopia they thought it was. But at the time, in the 20s and 30s, right after the Russian Revolution, this was very highly thought of in this country. Go down to New Harmony, Indiana, and look at what was established there by Robert Owen and others as a utopian civilization, and find out how long that lasted. Look at the Oneida Colony. There are numerous examples of this. The futile speculations of men at the time, they seem so brilliant. They seem so convincing. But later, when it's no longer in style, the futility shows. All the utopian schemes of men will pass away. But the Bible gives us information to help us from being taken in by these in the first place. When man willfully ignores God and then he cleverly reasons against God, when man won't stand for God, he'll fall for anything. And so then, step number three is that man replaces God. Verse 23, and changed or exchanged the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Amazing. But man replaces God. God is set aside and replaced by things that God himself has made, and the creature is worshipped and served more than the creator, or he's replaced by man himself or by something that man has made, as in technology, as in materialism. Man replaces God. Well, so far it might seem to be so good. So we have a technological, materialistic society. Everything's going along pretty well. The problem is, in verse 24, wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves. It doesn't stay as neat and clean and pretty as a new car. It turns into a debasing practice, and it turns into this every time man attempts it, in every culture where he attempts it. Give man long enough alone with other man, and he's going to dishonor his body worse than any animal will ever do. Given over to the complete, aggravated assault of their own lusts. And what happens then? When men get to this point, then God actually gives them up. And three times in this chapter that statement is made. Verse 24, verse 26, and verse 28. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness. 26, for this cause God gave them up to their vile affections. Verse 28, they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. God gave them over to a reprobate mind, to do those things which are neither decent nor honorable. God actively abandons man to even greater moral corruption. So man has the truth, but he doesn't want it. He exchanges it for a lie. And suppressing the truth incites the wrath of God. People who refuse to respond to the truth about God are objects of the wrath of God, and they are classified in the Bible as fools. Paul has given us in Romans 1 here a systematic, organized depicting of how we get into that condition. If we choose to not change and remain on that path, it's the path to hell. What must I do to be lost? Nothing. If you're outside of Christ, stay as you are, and your destiny is hell. But embracing the truth of God invites the righteousness of God to be yours. course, you need no righteousness if you're already righteous. This is why Jesus said, I did not come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance. In order for you to embrace the righteousness of God as portrayed in the gospel, you must admit the awful condition of your sinful life. You must recognize it for what that is. And we must be careful in our approach when sometimes even our own children become of the age and disposition where they want to accept the gospel and the Lord who gave it. We must recognize that, yes, even our own children are sinners. One time, I was in a certain place and a 17-year-old girl came forward to confess the Lord and be immersed. And I tried to depict the idea of what it means to come out of sin and into salvation. That was not a picture that some of us in the group like to have drawn. Why, we've known this girl all our lives. There's nothing that can be said against her. They didn't come out and say it, but in essence, I'm not sure they believed that really she was a sinner, but she was. She may not have been guilty of the kinds of sin that run down a person's reputation in a community. But there is none righteous, no, not one. So it's not a question of, if I've done something wrong, then I'm sorry. But you have done things wrong, and you know it. If you look at yourself from a God's eye point of view, you will definitely know it. And what can wash away my sin? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. Embracing the truth of God invites the righteousness of God into my heart. That's the way this transaction happens. When we come to God on His own terms. In order for you to embrace this righteousness, you've got to admit the awful condition of your sinful life. Because if you die without Jesus Christ, you're a fool and you're going to hell. There is no second chance. There is no brief rescission to change your mind. But in Jesus Christ, you can know love and forgiveness and heaven. It's a clear-cut choice. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God and I'm okay. The wise says, I'm not okay, but there is a God who wants to save me. Which do you say today? You're on one side of that ledger or the other. We hope that you'll take advantage of the opportunity that's presented to you now by the congregation here and by the Lord Jesus Christ Himself. To come to Jesus Christ on His own terms, nothing in my hand I bring, simply to Thy cross I cling, recognizing that we are utterly worthless, totally sinful, and that only our meaning can only be found within Him. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. That's not always an affirmation of atheism. Sometimes it means I'm going to live as though there's no God, ignoring Him and ignoring any consequences. It's easy to go that way for a while. Pretty soon the going gets rougher. Is it getting rougher for you? If it is, why continue to rebel against the goads? Why not come to Him on His own terms? And in doing so, become a fool for God and be wise in His estimation. If you have anything to bring before this assembled group this morning, let us know about that by coming up to one of these front seats as we stand together.